Okay, so this week we are in Leviticus 16 and 17. I call it the Atonement Day. Last week we looked at the Opening Day. We're in a period here on the calendar, the Jewish calendar, which is after the Feast of Trumpets, and the Jews call this the Jewish New Year. But the beginning of their year isn't in this month. The beginning of their year is in the spring, Passover. This is a new beginning, however, in the sense that the nation is refreshed. Everything is wiped clean. So it's the term new in the sense of to be refreshed and not the beginning, not the head of the year. We're at the time of the year when everything gets made new again. Yom Kippur is what it's called. It's in the seventh month on the tenth day. And the Feast of Trumpets is the seventh month, the first day. And what the Feast of Trumpets does, it calls everyone to this time of year. And it begins a time of reflection, repentance, conviction. And this day, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is the only required fast day in the entire Old Testament. Of the seven holidays, this is the only one where they're not feasting and celebrating. They're mourning their sin and they're repenting. Chapter 16 is part of this Day of Atonement. And the stress in Leviticus 16 is, "You shall be clean. For on this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean before the Lord from all your sins." So this is a reboot, if you will. This is a start over. From this day on, they're clean until the next year. Chapter 17 is also Yom Kippur. The focus verse in that chapter is right here. "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you, I've given you the blood, upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." Now the soul in Hebrew is the living person. Both the visible, the physical, and the invisible, or the inner person, the thoughts, the emotion, the will, everything about the person was life. From the Hebrew perspective, a person is seen as a unity. In the Western mind, we think in terms of a duality, spiritual segment, and I have a physical segment. And what I do with my body really doesn't affect what happens to my spirit. That's Greek dualism. We think of the soul as that part of us that goes to heaven. The Jews didn't think of it like that. They thought of the person, both body and inner life, going to paradise. And what they saw paradise as the coming kingdom. You know, both are true. Because our soul, once we're separated from our bodies, our soul, our spirit does go to heaven. Why, when we are in heaven in our soul, what are we waiting for? Our physical body, our new body. And so in order to have atonement for your souls, for your lives, both physical and spiritual, you've got to have a blood sacrifice. There must be a blood atonement. There must be a substitution. Now this brings us to the high point of what I say is the Torah. Leviticus and Leviticus 16 and 17 are the mountain peak of the Torah. Everything in the Torah, from Genesis to Exodus, leads up to this time in Leviticus. And Leviticus in chapter 16 is leading us and bringing us to the peak of this mountain. Chapter 16 is "Be clean." And this is really focusing on the physical. Chapter 17, it's "Be forgiven." God can say, "I have forgiven you for everything because there's blood atonement." So that brings us to the peak, 16 and 17. You know, people try to read through Leviticus. Generally, they'll get to about chapter 14 and give up. Because it really is pretty dry. It doesn't relate. We can't relate to that in our culture. But this is the peak of it. If you can get here, it all begins to make sense. And then everything in the Torah flows out of this. From Numbers down to Deuteronomy. Now when you take the whole Torah, those five books, that's the foundation for the rest of the Bible. Let's back up and look at this. How do we get to this, "You shall be clean"? Well, that brings us to chapters 11 through 15, really lead us up to 16, and this really concentrates and focuses on physical life. And it talks about things like diet and childbirth, diseases and discharges, things that come out of your body that sometimes are normal and natural and sometimes they're not. Diet, this is where he gives the kosher laws, the laws of what the Jews called the kashrut. You can eat these animals, but you cannot eat these animals. Why did God say you can eat this animal, but not this animal? Was it for health reasons? People think that. In fact, there's whole books written on that, that the reason God gave kosher laws is because it keeps us healthier. Pure, unadulterated hokum. He says, I've chosen these animals over these animals just simply because I did. I'm God, and I decided these animals you're going to keep separate from these animals. It's all about separation and distinction. You know why he's doing that? It's an object lesson for the nation of Israel to say, you are different from all other nations. Why have I chosen you among all other nations to make you special and distinct and my special possession? Why did I do that? Because I'm God, and I decided to do it. That's all there is to it. If these had to do with health, then what God said to Peter in the book of Acts wouldn't make any sense. Because he said to Peter, Peter, now you can eat anything you want. Peter says, no, I can't, Lord, I'm kosher. I'm a Jew, I can't eat pork. God says, no, everything is clean now. Everything is okay to eat. You can go up there with the Gentiles, you can go up there and eat with them, you can eat their pork, it's fine. Now, if pork was unhealthy, why would he tell Peter to do that? This is purely about separation and distinction. They couldn't eat certain foods. That made them different from the other nations around them. So this is all talking about physical cleanness, clean versus unclean. This is summarized in this verse right here, 11:44 through 47. Look at 11:44 through 47. Let's look at that, because this is where this statement comes from. You be holy because I am holy, which is in essence saying you be perfect because I am perfect. Verse 44. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy. You know, separate yourselves and be holy. For I am holy, and you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction. There's the key word right there. To make a distinction between the clean and the unclean. That's the point. Between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. That's the point. There's nothing wrong with the animals I've told you not to eat, but I've told you not to eat them because that's what I want from you. Later on, I'm going to tell Peter he can go ahead and eat them. I didn't tell him that here, but we know he did that. The summary of this section is in 14, if you look at 1454. 1454 said, these are the laws about dreaded skin diseases, sores, boils, or inflammation, and about mildew in clothes or houses. These laws determine when something is unclean and when it is clean, not when it is something that's sinful and not sinful. This is clean and unclean, purely physical. And the Lord takes physical uncleanness very seriously. Physical uncleanness is a manifestation of the fall, and it says that is what God is going to restore. Okay, let's look at the other side. Let's look at the 17 side. This is chapters 18 through 20. 17 begins that section, 18 through 20. This is not going to simply be talking about physical cleanness and uncleanness. This is going to start getting to issues of the heart. And this is going to talk about immorality. This is going to talk about marriage and immorality, idolatry and sorcery, cheating and lying. He's going to cover all these things in these chapters. When you look at just chapter 19, most of the Ten Commandments are repeated in some form in chapter 19. Holy versus defiled. And this is not just physical defilement. This is not just having a discharge or a boil that's creating pus or something like that, which is not sinful, but God says, I'm not going to accept it. But here, this is issues of the heart. To defile your heart, if you defile your heart, your person, if you and your person decide you're going to cheat your neighbor, you'll end up there. These are moral sins. Now, these are the kinds of sins, however, that are covered by the Day of Atonement. So see, the Day of Atonement's looking at the whole package. Go to chapter 19. And the whole law is summed up in verse 17. And this, I think, is one of the most fascinating verses in the book of Leviticus, the way he puts it here. Let me read it in today's English version, because I like the way they translate this. Do not bear a grudge against anyone. That's verse 17. But settle your differences with him so that you will not commit a sin because of him. Because of him. And now really, is it because of him you're going to sin? No, it's because it's something you don't like about him and you're holding a grudge against him. So whose fault is this? Do not take revenge on anyone or continue to hate him. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. I am the Lord. Now, I want you to look at something. I want you to go to Galatians chapter 5. I want you to look at something there. Go to Galatians chapter 5. So remember how this starts. Don't hold a grudge. Because if you hold a grudge, you're going to do something wrong. Love your neighbor like you love yourself. Look at Galatians 5:14. The Apostle Paul says, "For the whole law is summed up in one commandment." The whole law. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Look what he goes on to say. "But if you act like wild animals, hurting and harming each other, then watch out. You will completely destroy one another." Do you notice what's happened there? Leviticus 19, 17, and 18 say don't hold a grudge because you're going to end up sinning against this person. Love him like you love yourself. Paul takes it and turns it around. It's a mirror image. Paul turns it around and says, the whole law is summed up in this. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you do that, you won't violate him at all. But Paul says, what you people are doing, you're hurting each other. Why are you hurting each other? And what's going to happen? You're going to completely destroy each other. Holding a grudge will lead to actions. And really, Leviticus 19 is saying your mental attitude will lead to physical action. Paul is saying to the Galatians, I can tell by your physical actions, by the reports I'm getting, the way you're treating each other, I can tell your mental attitude. Is it loving the Lord? Is it loving your neighbor like you love yourself if you're doing this to each other? If you see someone holding resentment and then getting even with someone, would you conclude their mental attitude is they love the Lord more than anything else? Did they love that person like they love themselves? No. You would conclude their mental attitude is one where they hold a grudge. Because a grudge is held in the heart. It's what you do with the grudge that leads to the action. Love is something you hold in your heart. But what should come out of that? What you do for people. See how this puts together this idea that it's not a duality, it's a unity, a person? In verse 19:1, he says, you be holy because I'm holy. It's like he's going to repeat in this section kind of the high point of the last section, 11 through 15. Be holy because I'm holy, both in the area of cleanness physically and the area of morality in your heart. So God's saying, what I want to have happen, I want your heart to match your life to what people see. Well, let's get to Yom Kippur. Seventh month, 10th day. Starting in chapter 16, what he does in the first four verses, he gives instructions. Let's look at that. The Lord comes and speaks to Moses. What did we do last week? 8, 9, and 10, opening day. What happens at the end of opening day? Two boys die. Notice how he starts 16. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, who were killed when they offered unholy fire to the Lord. He said, tell your brother Aaron that only at the proper time is he to go behind the curtain into the most holy place, because that is where I appear in a cloud above the lid on the covenant box. Now, some of your translations might have mercy seat on the box. The word there in Hebrew is cover. I will appear in a cloud on the cover of the ark, or the box. The Hebrew word is kippur. That's the word cover. If he disobeys, he will be killed. Now, do they think they think the Lord's serious about that? No, why? What did they just see? He starts a sentence after the death of the two sons. So this could happen to you, Aaron, just like happened to them. Verse 3, he may enter the most holy place only after he has brought a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Then the Lord gave the following instructions. Before Aaron goes into the most holy place, he must take a bath, put on the priestly garments, the linen and the robe and the shorts, the belt and the turban. These are very plain. These are plain white garments with a belt and a turban. That's all. He's going to look just like a common person. He's going to humble himself before he goes through this process that he's going to go through. Here's what God says to bring. I want you to bring these offerings. I want the priest to have a bull, which it said there, for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering. I want the people to bring two male goats. One is going to be for a sin offering. One ram for a burnt offering. One goat is going to die for sins. I'm going to call him the slain goat. The other goat is going to bear the sins. I'm going to call him the scapegoat. Now, what's a scapegoat? We use that word in our language, don't we? Is you blame somebody else. A scapegoat can have two. There's two facets to this. It's you're looking for somebody to blame for something that went wrong, whether they did it or not. A scapegoat is also one who's willing to take the blame even though he hasn't done the wrong thing. It can work both ways. But generally, we're looking for somebody to blame because that's the way our hearts are wired, to find somebody else to say it's their fault. So here we come to 11 through 19. Here's the rituals. If you're reading 11 through 19, it's going to describe these rituals. I'm going to show it to you in picture form because it's a little easier to understand and follow. But I want to bring you back to the design of the holy place and the Holy of Holies. The holy place is this outer part of the tent. The Holy of Holies is the inner part of the tent. And it's in the outer part. Remember, the table of showbread's here, the lampstand is here, and the altar of incense is there. The altar of incense is right in front of the veil that separates these two places, and behind the most holy place is the lid, the cover of the box. And in the box, the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments express God's character. You violate one of those, you violate His character. That's what has to be covered. That's where atonement comes in. If you fall short of the standard that He's got in that box, you're out. The ark, the lid, the cover over the box is where no one can go except for this high priest once a year dressed the way he is in humble clothing. Out here is the altar of the burnt offering. That's where we're going to offer the animals. Here's the laver where the priests wash. Only the priests. This is the courtyard. All right, so what happens? Aaron takes the bull and he kills it. That's a sin offering for himself. He goes and he takes some coals from the altar, some hot pieces of wood, and he's going to put them on a pan, and he's going to carry them back to the altar of incense. He's going to put some incense on that pan on the way. And what he's going to do, God says, when you get in there, I want you to make smoke. I want you to make so much smoke that you actually can't see in there when you open that curtain. So God says, I want you to hide the covering of the box. So once he does that, and there's all this smoke in there, he comes back out, and he goes back to get some blood from the bull he's just killed, and he's poured the blood around the base of the altar. So he's going to scoop up some of that, and he's going to take it back, and he's going to sprinkle it inside the veil. He's going to sprinkle some on the front of the box. And then he's going to sprinkle 7 times on the ground in front of the box. Once he does that, he's going to go back out. He's going to kill the goat that the people brought, the slain goat, for the sin offering. He's going to kill that goat. He's going to take some of that goat's blood, and he's going to take that into the holy place, sprinkle some on the front of the box, and then sprinkle some in front of the box. And that blood is going to cover, it's going to make atonement for the sins, not only for the priest, the high priest and the priest, but for the people. Now, once he does that, he's going to go back out. You know, the blood of the bull and the blood of the goat, he's going to take some of that, and he's going to wipe it on the horns of the altar. And then he's going to take some, and he's going to sprinkle it around the altar. Once he does that, he's going to get the scapegoat, which is the goat that's going to bear the guilt of the sins of the people. He has a guy called an escort that's going to take that goat out into the wilderness. And he's going to wander off into the wilderness and eventually die, bearing the guilt of all the sins of the entire nation. Sin has been covered by the blood taken back into the holy place and sprinkled on that box. Sin has been wiped away. The horns of the altar are wiped, and sin gets sent away as far as the east is from the west. So there's a picture of 3 things the way God deals with sin. He covers our sin, He wipes away our sin, He sends away our sin. All sin and impurity is covered on this day. Look at 16:20. When Aaron has finished performing the ritual to purify the most holy place, purifying this place where God comes to dwell, because the sin out in the nation causes defilement of the holy place. So God says, in order for me to dwell here, I must cleanse it. And you've got to do it this way. you don't do it this way, what did he tell Aaron? You don't do it this way, what did he say? You're going to die. Proof was the two boys. So 16:20. He's come to purify the most holy place, the rest of the tent of the Lord's presence, and the altar, and he shall present to the Lord the live goat chosen for Azazel. So everything's been covered, now he's going to send it away. Go on 21 and 22. He shall put both of his hands on the goat's head and confess over it all the evils, the sins, and the rebellion. See, everything in those chapters, 11 through 15 and 18 through 20, of the people of Israel. And so transfer them to the goat's head, and the goat is to be driven off into the desert by a man appointed to do it, and the goat will carry all their sins away with him into some uninhabited land. An uninhabited, lonely, depressing, guilt-ridden land. Later the Bible will call that a place like that hell. And it's this goat that will bear that guilt. It's all done. The goat's sent away, all the animals are dead. Now, the cleanup. Well, what happens in the cleanup? 23 through 28, Aaron undresses, takes off the garments that he has just used to do all these sacrifices. They're probably bloody. He's going to wash. He's going to put back on the high priest's clothes. He's going to now assume the identity and the authority that he has as high priest. The scapegoat's escort washes and changes his clothes. He's come back in from the desert. Aaron as high priest then offers both the burnt offerings as a high priest in his high priest garb now that were brought by the people, the burnt offering. Remember, the rams that were for burnt offerings? And then Aaron offers the fat of the sin offering. The rest of all of the fat of the animal, the bull that he's killed originally. Only the fat, none of the organs, just the fat. And the rest of this bull is taken outside the camp and burned outside the camp. Look at 27 and 28. I want you to look at that. 16, 27 and 28. The bull and the goat used for the sin offering, both of these animals. I only focused on the bull, but it's both of these animals are sin offerings, whose blood was brought into the most holy place to take away sin, shall be carried outside the camp and burned. Skin, meat, intestines, everything burned. The one who burns them then must wash his clothes and take a bath before he returns to the camp. So they take them completely outside the camp to be burned up. Not just outside the perimeter of the courtyard, but outside the camp to be burned up. Now let's look at something that correlates with that, that's more, it's applicable to us. Go to Hebrews 13:11. I'm going to pick it up in verse 10 because he's making a point here that if you are a member of the body of Jesus Christ and believe in Him, and he's talking to Jewish people here, so they understand more what he's saying than we do. He's saying, we have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. Now, he's talking about the Levitical priests. We serve a priest, because he's talking about Jesus being high priest, who's serving at an altar, which is in heaven. And those who are still in that temple over there physically, they have no right to come and eat of the altar that where Jesus is right now. That's the contrast he's making. We who believe in Jesus have a much better deal than those guys over there in that temple. So see, the question he's posing to people that he's writing to is, then why do you want to go back there? See, what he's writing about here are people who want to go back to temple service and leave Jesus Christ. You know why they want to leave Jesus Christ and go back to temple service? They're being persecuted. They're losing their homes. They're being jailed. They're losing their lives for one reason. They believe in Jesus. If I want to get off the hook, I go back and make friends with the guys I left and say, I'm sorry I left. I'm back. Will you accept me back? These are the guys who put him on the cross. You want to go back and unite with them? See, to the writer of Hebrews, that makes no sense. And we have a better altar than they got. Now, I want to get to 11. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin, which is what they do once a year, the bodies of those animals are burned outside the camp. Don't you see that? These bodies are burned outside the camp. The bodies of the sin offerings aren't burned in the temple. So look at his conclusion. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered what? Outside the gate. Yes. Hence, let us go to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Yeah, you're being persecuted. You think he wasn't? Be like him.
Don't go back there.
That's the exhortation. They have nothing to offer. Now, Jesus died outside the camp as an offering for sin. And he's not a Levitical priest. Jesus was not a Levitical priest. But all of the sacrifices that the Levitical priest did point to what he would do, not only what he would do on the cross, but what he does for us now in heaven. Constantly interceding, constantly making up for what we lack. We can go to him anytime when we have a need, and he says, I will do everything in my power to meet that need, to do my will and to do my Father's will. Amazing stuff. So that's Yom Kippur. That's the cleanup. Everything is pretty much done now as far as the ceremony, the cleanup, and everything. So what's chapter 17 for? Chapter 17 is a chapter that explains what just happened. It gives meaning to why all this blood. Chapter 17 is about blood is holy. Blood is holy. Now, and what he's going to do in 17, 1 through 7, he's going to give new rules about meat and offering. What meat can you eat and when can you eat it? You can only eat sacrificial meat, animals that are clean that can be offered for sacrifice, goats, lambs, cows, bulls, etc. If you're going to eat those, and there's nothing wrong with eating meat, but if you're going to eat those, you've got to take those to the temple and offer those. Now, something else like a deer or some other kind of animal that you can eat, you don't have to take that to the temple in order to kill it and eat it. Now, there's something you got to keep in mind here. They didn't eat a lot of meat. Meat was expensive. Animals were expensive. People did eat meat, but they didn't eat meat like we eat meat. They ate meat rather sparingly. But he's saying here, I'm going to regulate the way you eat your meat and the kind of animals you eat, depending on the animal, whether it's a sacrificial animal or not. If it's a sacrificial animal, you got to bring that and offer it before a priest. Then you take your portion, he takes his portion, and you go off and eat yours, and he gets to eat his with his family. See, it all revolved around how are these priests going to be supported, because they don't own any land. So their livelihood depends on the people bringing their sacrifices and offerings, as well as their tithes to the temple. You must offer these only at the tent of meeting. Last thing, and no more offering to goat demons. No more just killing your goat out there and praying to the goat demons to come and bless you, because this is what they're doing. Where did they learn to do this? They learned to do this from Canaanites. They learned to do this actually before they even went down to Egypt. So he says, there's not going to be any more of that. You can't just offer an animal wherever you want anymore. If you're going to offer an animal to the Lord, it's got to be in the right place. Offer a sacrificial animal in an open field, you're going to die. He's serious about that. How do you know? He just killed two boys. Offer to goat demons, that's idolatry. You'll die. That's a sin. You'll die for that. Eat blood, you die. He's going to say that next. New rules about blood. No one, native or alien, can eat blood. Eat blood, you die. Now, this is something he says in 17:11. The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life of the animal whose blood was shed. So that's saying that if you bleed an animal out, what's going to happen to that animal? He's going to die. He's going to lose his life. He's going to lose his ability to act. That's true for a human as well. And this is, again, where you get that idea. The soul is a living person. It's not just simply something inside this body that I carry around. It's the whole person, physical and spiritual. 17:14, he says that again. The life of every creature is its blood, is the blood. Its blood is its life. You shall not eat the blood of any flesh. That's like eating the animal's life. For the life of all flesh is its blood. And whoever eats it will be cut off. Now, cut off goes all the way from the range of no more temple service. You're not going to live in this nation any longer. I'm going to kick you off this land, to I may take your life. So it's a whole spectrum of things that can occur to you. Now, God may let you live and may have you run off from the land, and you may repent and come back, just like the prodigal son. But you will be cut off if you eat blood. You do not partake of my life by drinking an animal's blood. You partake of my life by taking that animal and using that blood as an atonement for your sins. That animal is going to take your place, so now I can have a relationship with you. But if you don't do that, there's no relationship. Now, when Jesus came along, what did he say? You eat my body and drink my blood. Why does he use that expression? Blood is life. So he's saying, if you want my life, you partake of me. He's not saying, you know, cut me open and literally drink my blood. Because it's made very clear here. What is blood? Blood is life. You can take what he says and make sense out of it without taking it literally. Because he is God. And you can have a relationship now with God through him. So this we think, well, this is only applies to the Jewish people. They're the only ones that can't eat blood. No. I say that's that's wrong. You know where God first said this? He said this back to Noah. Noah got off the ark. Now he's saying to them, he says, okay, now that you're off the ark, the earth is completely changed. It's a whole new environment. You're now going to be able to eat animals. And animals are going to be afraid of humans for the first time. There's going to be a fear of humans and animals. And God says, you can eat animals now, but you shall not eat flesh with its life. What? With its life? What do you mean? Well, with its blood. You've got to drain the blood out. Because you can't eat a live animal. Canaanites would do that too. Whoever sheds man's blood, this extends not just to animals, but to man. By man, his blood will be shed. This is the first time God's going to put the responsibility for murder in the hands of man. That if a man sheds another man's blood, men as a government will take his life. For in the image of God, he's made man. When you kill a man, you're not just killing another animal. You're killing the very image of God. So we think, okay, that's Old Testament. It has nothing to do with me. That guy can take that deer or cow or whatever, drink that blood. Doesn't make any difference. Oh, no, Vern. That's not true. Look at that. This is the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15. The dispute is over the gospel. What is it that you must tell Gentiles they must do in order to be saved? Paul said, you tell them to have faith in Jesus Christ and faith alone. But here's what they concluded. That's true. It's my judgment. We do not trouble those who are turning to God from the Gentiles and might try to make them Jews, is what he's saying. They don't have to become Jews. But we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols. That's idolatry. So we don't want Christians being idolaters. And from fornication, that's a no-brainer. We don't want Christians being immoral. And from what is strangled. Because if you strangle an animal and eat it, what's it got in it? The blood. See, the Canaanites did this. Still people eating animals that have been strangled. And don't eat blood. Why? Because the life is in the blood. Blood is not a beverage. That's the point. Blood is not a beverage. And blood will not gain you access into some other supernatural power of another god. You might think eating and drinking the blood of that bull as the blood is pouring down on you is going to get you access to this god that you worship. It's not. That's idolatry. The life of the animal is in the blood. You cannot drink the blood. But eat rare meat, what's happened to the animal before you get your steak on the table? That animal's been bled out. And you're getting a piece of meat, yeah, that's got blood in it, but you're not drinking blood as a beverage. Of course, the whole Jehovah's Witness thing here comes into play on this verse. This is the verse they use to say, we can't receive blood transfusions. Receiving a blood transfusion is not drinking blood. It's not eating blood. It's saving your life. Why? Because you want to stay alive, and God wants us to stay alive until he takes our lives. If you can get a blood transfusion to stay alive, the life is in the blood. Now, we've had an interesting thing happen here since the 80s. We've had something come into our blood. People are now afraid of blood, called HIV. Changed the whole picture of blood transfusions and the way people think about getting a blood transfusion. Blood now all of a sudden wasn't a source of life. It could be a source of death. That's God kind of bringing consequences to bear on things that we do as humans. And God has a right to do that. My recommendation for you is not to use blood as a beverage as a Christian. Yeah.
That seems like good advice.
It seems like good advice, doesn't it? So what we found here from 7:11-14 in those two verses we read, that blood is life, right? We all got that, right? If I come back next week and say, what is blood? You're going to say, hey, yeah. And then I feel good as a teacher. I've taught something. You think this closes with the end of chapter 17. It doesn't. It goes into a hinge. 18:1-5. Look at this. Walk with me. And that is life. You'll never have a better life than a life where you walk with God and do things the way He wants them done. Look at 18:1-5. The Lord told Moses, "Say to the people of Israel, I am the Lord your God. Do not follow the practices of the people of Egypt where you once lived." So you've left that behind. Don't go back there. Don't go back to their culture. Don't go back to the things they do. "Or of the people in the land of Canaan, where I am now taking you." You think they were bad in Egypt? They were pretty good people. The Egyptians were really pretty good people. But where you're going? Ooh, that's ugly. That's really bad. "Obey my laws and do what I command. I am the Lord your God." He says it again. "I am your God. My name is the Lord. Follow the practices and the laws that I give you, and you will save your life by doing so. I am the Lord." In the New American Standard, it doesn't say it quite that clearly. Verse 5, "If you keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man may live if he does them, I am the Lord." So if you want to walk with me and have life, do what I tell you. Now he's talking to people who are his children. You think he's saying here, in order to become his child, I got to obey these commands and all these laws or I can't get in? No. He's not talking about anything but their sanctification. 18:5 says, "I'm talking about your sanctification. The way for you to be holy is to walk with me." He's not talking about justification, meaning you don't get in by keeping these laws. You get in by me declaring you righteous, just like I did Abraham back there in Genesis chapter 15. You believe in me and you're in. But once you're in, I have total demands on your life. I get to tell you what you do and don't do. You can eat lamb, but you cannot eat pork. Why, Lord? Because I said so. That's why. Why, Dad? Because I said so. That's why. Let's go to Galatians. Galatians 3:11. "Now that no one is justified by the law before God is evident." And Paul's going to quote Habakkuk. And he's going to say, "Because the righteous man will live by his faith." So it's faith that brings a person to righteousness. And now notice what he says, "the righteous man, how should he live then after he's being righteous?" By faith. By faith in whom? In the Lord, who has demands on your life. And so the righteous man will recognize that and move on. Now look what he says. "However, the law is not about faith. On the contrary, he who practices them shall live by them." Verse 13, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law." Why is the law a curse? Because if you fail, you're out. "Having become a curse for us," just like that scapegoat and that slain goat. "For it is written, curses everyone who hangs on a tree." Jesus exhibited himself as being cursed by God because he was placed on a cross. Now, why does Paul say this? Because I just read in Leviticus 18:5 that really to walk with God and to obey his commandments is a source of your life. It's a source of life in the sense that as you walk with him, he sanctifies you. He makes you more and more like himself. But if you're not his child, you're not going to reflect that kind of father. You only reflect the father that you have. And if God is your father, he wants you to reflect his character. What the rabbis did was they took that and said, in order to have life, in order to be a son of God, you must keep all the law. You know what Paul's saying here? The rabbis were wrong. The rabbis were completely wrong. You do not become righteous by keeping the law, but you're conformed to the image of God by obeying his commands. And our commands in the New Testament are actually more rigorous than the commands of the Old Testament. We have more truth, more light, more responsibility than they had. And religions today, just like the rabbis back then were wrong, religions today are wrong. Works-based religion, Paul says in Philippians, is what? Rubbish. Remember, he says, everything I was as a Jew, I've thrown in the trash can. And my only pursuit now is Jesus Christ. I no longer care what I had as a rabbi. And I was a rabbi of rabbis. I was one of the greatest of rabbis. I don't care. I threw it all away. So works-based religion is rubbish. That's what Paul's saying here. I think we're afraid to witness, especially to religious people, because we're afraid to say that Jesus is the only way. Your works don't matter. Your religion doesn't matter. Whether it be Catholic or Mormon or whatever it is, doesn't matter. Jesus is the only way. That is separation. That is what separates Christians who know Jesus from everybody else. I didn't work for my position, but God has called me to work for His glory. And that's the point Leviticus is making. God's not showing a way for the nation to become a nation. They already are a nation. He's showing them the way for the nation to keep itself clean and pure and holy so He doesn't dump His wrath on them. Because if they turn to other gods and go off into idolatry and immorality like a good father, He's going to get out the belt, or He's going to take the car keys away, or He's going to do something to make them uncomfortable, to cause them to see the error of their ways. All the way down to the point, He says, I'm going to kick you out of the house until you learn to obey my rules. And that's why they got kicked out of the land. That's why they're not in the land today. They're out wandering out in the world. But what's God going to do someday? He's going to bring them all back together. Why? Because they are His people. And we get a prophetic glimpse of that when we go to the next chapter we're going to go to next week, chapter 23, the holidays. And we get a glimpse of what He will do in the future. What these holidays are, they're all prophetic. And for the Jewish people living in the time of the Old Testament, they all look forward to Messiah. But for us, they take us back. We can look back and see how some of them are fulfilled. They also make us look forward. But we're not looking forward just for some nameless Messiah. We're looking forward to Jesus. And He could come at any moment. So that's where we're going next week. We're out of time. And my friend Ken over there, he looks so nice, doesn't he? He's going to pray for us.